From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past Friday when State Education Commissioner Mary Ellen Elia announced that the Rochester City School District's distinguished educator, Jaime Aquino, had resigned his position. The department said he was leaving the district on June 7th to pursue another opportunity. Aquino's resignation adds to the uncertainty of the district's future, as state education officials have proposed a plan to replace the city school board, the elected board, with a state-appointed board for at least 5 years. And Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren is in favor of the plan. Critics have argued it is undemocratic, and we've got an election coming up. So, meanwhile, the race for the seats on the Rochester City School Board forges ahead, with candidates gearing up for the primary election 3 weeks from today. This hour, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates, giving you a chance to hear their platforms and priorities for the district's future. Last week, we talked to current Commissioner Beatrice LeBron, along with candidates Anthony Hall, Robert Hoggard, and Minister Clifford Florence. And today, I'm joined in studio by current Commissioner Willa Powell. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is current Commissioner Reverend Judy Davis. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Amy Malloy is here, a teacher in the Brighton School District with 4 kids in the Rochester City School District. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And again, listeners, all of these interviews are cataloged online. We invite you to kind of make sure before you go to vote, listen at length. It's a chance to hear the candidates. And there's a lot to talk about. Now, no one that I know of who's running for school board supports the plan for a state takeover, but I've got to ask you. So, Reverend Davis, I'll start with you. What do you make of not only the plan, but also the support from people like Mayor Warren, who say there's been too much failure for far too long, it's time for this kind of a takeover?
I understand that basically here in Rochester that this has been going on for 4 decades, so it's completely understandable that persons are frustrated and searching for solutions, searching for answers. Not only that, the public itself is putting pressure, I know, on Mayor Warren and others to do something. And so to pursue this path that's been chosen, I can't castigate it because reality is something does need to be done. I just don't agree with the path or the solution being chosen. When I wrote Commissioner Elia in a letter, when the board sent out its response to the distinguished educator, in that letter, I recommended that we have one table at which all persons, grandparents, parents, caregivers, ministers, teachers, educators, administrators, one table at which we sit and come together and discuss possible solutions rather than having a small group of people make a decision.
Okay. Amy Malloy, how do you feel about it?
I completely agree with Judith on this. And, you know, I really empathize with our mayor. I think she's expressing frustration. I absolutely do not agree with a state takeover. That shouldn't happen. It's not democratic, first and foremost. But I think what we're hearing from so many of our community members is this frustration that's been building year after year after year. So, yeah, I completely concur with Judith on this. Something has to change, and we have to be willing to make that change.
Okay. Willa?
Thank you. Well, first let me start back you up to your setup and say that while Jaime Aquino did submit his resignation, it was only days before his tenure with us was going to end anyway. He was not expected to be on our payroll beyond 6 months after the initial report. And he gave his second of 2 quarterly reports and essentially determined that
his work was done anyway.
Work is done anyway, right.
Okay.
So to your question about state takeover, I bring up the distinguished educator point because I want to remind our listening audience that Buffalo was assigned a distinguished educator. Buffalo had a dysfunctional board. Buffalo survived both of those things without a state takeover. The distinguished educator gave a very different kind of report than what our distinguished educator gave us, much less detailed, served for the same period of time, and the state basic and their test scores and graduation rates leapfrogged past Rochester, but only minutely, exceeding our numbers. Since the distinguished educator was appointed, our test scores and graduation rates have shown considerable improvement, as they have been for several years in a row. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that for the commissioner to be considering a takeover or any other extraordinary measure that they were not willing to take with Buffalo, it strikes me as arbitrary and capricious, which is like about the worst thing you can say about any governmental action.
Okay. Listeners, we'll share your questions or comments if you like. It's connections at WXXI.org for an email address. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Please, Reverend.
I really don't want to underscore the importance of the Distinguished Educators Report. Because it's more extensive than the report that was in Buffalo, I'm pleased that was more extensive. It really has laid out a roadmap for us of best practices across the whole district and all district departments. And so I wouldn't want to the listening audience to downplay the importance of the roadmap that the distinguished educator has left for us.
Okay. And so what's priority one then for you, Reverend? If you are elected and you get a chance of walking right in there in 2020, there is no state takeover, the board is going to continue in its role. What is priority one and how do you accomplish that work for you?
For myself, it would be concentrating on teaching and learning and looking at the recommendations that Dr. Aquino left us of having an aligned curriculum across the district, because we have students that move during the year, and if they're moving to another school, that school's not teaching the same things the school that they just left was teaching. So I would like to see many of the recommendations under teaching and learning addressed. But more important than that is I'd like to see an actual strategic plan for the district. I'd actually like to see a district comprehensive plan. I know they're working on and school plans, but they can't just be plans that are going to sit on a shelf. They have to be plans that are actually implementable, which Dr. Aquino found that they were not. And even our strategic plan was not complete or finished. So in addition to wanting to have a plan that actually is going to lead us to academic improvement, we also have to have community organizing, and that's my platform. We have to organize grandparents, parents, community members, teachers, et cetera, to apply that outside pressure to create the political will in this district to actually implement and put into place the best practices that were outlined in the report. And I don't believe that will happen without outside pressure.
Okay. Amy Malloy, priority one for you.
Well, my main focus has been on student activism, family empowerment, and then community dialogue. I think we need to focus on that more than anything else. I agree completely with Judith on this. I feel we need to make sure that we have an implementable strategy. We need to collaborate together as professionals to see it to its finish. I'm really disappointed that the distinguished educator has stepped down. I actually think we still need to have a distinguished educator as we implement whatever plan we come up with together. So they need to be on hand to make sure that we're meeting our short and long-term goals. I'd also like to see maybe perhaps the creation of some type of student advisory board that can meet and offer feedback for student needs. And I'd also really like to see some type of community advisory board to help advise our board as well. We need to make sure that we have oversight, that we're fully implementing our community schools. We need to expand that. But all in all, we need to make sure that the people that we are serving, that they are heard, that they are part of this. So really, activism, family empowerment, and dialogue, we have to make sure that they are incorporated into whatever plan we come up with in a collaborative fashion.
All right. Willa?
Thank you. Well, teaching learning certainly is important. The focus that as a board member, as opposed to an educator, I would want to bring to this is the importance of changing the culture within our schools to end the soft bigotry of low expectations. It's part of the culture within our schools that allows our students to fail, not the curriculum, not the fact that teachers know what they need to teach. But before we can do any of that, the students have to be in our schools. They have to be in their seats. The attendance initiatives we have to double down on those and work even harder. There has to be a culture within our schools where teachers don't let the families off the hook, and they need to be constantly making phone calls after school hours asking, you know, why was Johnny not at school today? Is he coming to school tomorrow?
That's the teacher's job?
It's everyone's job in the institution. When I went to school, it was the teacher that reached out. That's what parent-teacher conferences are for. And if the parents aren't coming to the schools for parent-teacher conference, then the entire school needs to activate around other solutions. Maybe it's FaceTiming. You know, there are technological solutions that allow parents to be in the building without ever crossing the threshold.
Okay. Now, on this subject, I want to ask all of our guests to kind of weigh in on that, because it was in 2010 when now Senator Kamala Harris, then the Attorney General of the state of California, was having a conversation, I think in San Francisco. You might have seen the video earlier this year where she was kind of laughing about the fact that they created a plan where she was threatening parents with incarceration if the kids did not show up. And that there was some backlash to this plan, but there was also, I don't know, some outsiders who said, well, you've got to do something. How do you feel about that? How strong do we need to be, and whose responsibility is it? And what might change attendance in the RCSD, Judy?
Well, I'll let my colleagues go.
Okay, I'll speak on this. It's our collective responsibility. It's not just the teachers. It's not just the families. I certainly think that as a district, we need to make sure that we are helping to provide all the necessary supports to our families so that, whatever needs or social needs that need to be met are being met. Are we connecting them with appropriate social services or other resources in the community, to help pinpoint why it is that they can't get their children to school and why the kids aren't attending? Because there are just myriad reasons why kids are absent on a regular basis. One of the things I love about the community school effort is that it helps to address that by providing more for the social and emotional needs of students right there on campus, whether that's medical care, other social services. You have counseling programs, mental health services available. We need to expand on that in our most disadvantaged areas to make sure that those basic needs are being met and that the needs of the families are being met. I think that's the number one way to combat absenteeism.
Would you ever support incarcerating parents if their children?
Absolutely not. I think what's the point of that? I believe in restorative practices 100%. How is incarcerating a parent going to help a parent learn how to either get their child to school? And it's not even about learning how. It's what needs aren't being met within their family, that what is preventing them from getting to school in the first place. Chances are it's not based on anything criminal. It's simply some need isn't being met, and we have to address that.
Okay. Willa Powell.
Well, I agree with what Amy just said about some need is not being met. But I'm not prepared to say absolutely not. We don't know every possible situation in every possible home. There are cases where perhaps the parents are truly negligent or derelict in their role as a parent. But there's a lot that we as a district should and could be doing to support families who are just out of their depth. Now, I've been on the school board for many years. I've been a parent for 30 years. And I, a couple of years ago, had a child become very school avoidant. She would deliberately miss the bus. She would get off the bus at the library and not finish the route to get to school. I would drive her to school, watch her go in the front door, and by the time I got home, at second period, I got the phone call that said she wasn't in class. So there are times when parents need a lot more help than they can imagine on their own. What did I do? I asked the school to help district to help me file a PINS request, persons in need of supervision, for my daughter. Here I am, middle class, totally tuned in, but I needed help because her behaviors were well beyond what I had the capacity to understand. And having my daughter stand in front of a county family court judge In the case of Powell versus Powell, having her have to go and to a probation officer every month and talk about what was going on in her life and what she needed help with was exactly what we needed at the time. We as a district should not be afraid to offer every possible service, not just counseling, not just restorative justice conversation and reconciliation. We have to be prepared to go all the way down the line, including a PINS request or a CPS referral.
Okay. Reverend Davis.
It's funny you ask this question because just last week I was in a room with some individuals from the district, and I was uplifting the need for anti-racist education, and I was uplifting that chronic absenteeism is one manifestation of racism. You'll find that across this nation in urban centers. You'll find the disproportionate over-identification of students of color for disabilities, for special education. There's many manifestations of racism, but when I started on that road, that conversation, the room quickly turned to parents and what parents aren't doing. I feel that that conversation about parents hides something that's an elephant in the room, that's been an elephant in the room for decades or for centuries, and that's a lot of the manifestations that we see in our districts, our urban centers across this nation, are the manifestations of the impact of individual, institutional, and structural racism. Now, to answer your question, no, I would not arrest a parent. And yes, our parents do need assistance. But the question is, why? Why do parents need assistance? We can't just look at the educational system, and we can't just look at the present. We have to look at the historical and contemporary situation in housing, healthcare, education, employment, criminal justice in this nation, and particularly in Rochester, to understand why we have what we have in families and parents and in districts. So for myself, I think the place to start is to talk about the elephant in the room that we never talk about is the historical and ongoing impact of racism in Rochester and other urban centers.
And if we talk about that, let me extend this out now, because if we're having that conversation, does that also mean that we're teaching that more in classroom? More overtly, does the actual curriculum change? Is that part of what you see as a solution?
Right. One of the, in my platform from last year, I'm running again within 5 months, but that's a longer story. One of my platforms was that the school system has to respect the parents, the students, the community, and each one represents something. So the two E's, one E is equity in curriculum, and not using a Eurocentric curriculum, not starting with Greece and the accomplishments, but starting with Africa, starting with the original peoples. Also equity in staffing, having more teachers of color. Studies already show that African-American boys are 39% more likely to finish high school and to go on to college. They just have one teacher of color between third and fifth grade. So there's a lot of information that we know about the importance of race and education, and I like to see us actually implement the knowledge that we have had for centuries to address the elephant in the room that we avoid, and we go instead to talk about what parents aren't doing.
Before I get some listener feedback, one more follow-up for Judy, which is really for everyone. When you bring up especially children between third and fifth grade, mm-hmm. a student of color not having any teachers of color, mm-hmm. we know we have a huge lack of representation on public school teaching staffs, and that's true in Rochester, and that's true everywhere. It's true in every single district. And what I hear, no matter where I go, whether it's East Rochester or the city of Rochester or Brighton or elsewhere, is we're trying. We want more candidates of color. We care. It matters to us. And I don't doubt that. But I also see that the results don't change very much over the years. What do you see as a path to actually changing that?
I would really have to question that we're trying. I would really want to understand and understand what we're doing. I'm a part of racial equity advocacy leadership team here in Rochester, and we're working to develop a racial equity action plan for the district. And one of the things that we learned in having community members as a part of those meetings is how many people of color are right here in this district, and they're not made into full-time employees. They're left as substitutes. They're left as temporary. And we met a gentleman who's been temporary for 8 years. So I have to question if we really are what we are doing to diversify our staff.
Well, Amy, you teach in Brighton.
I do.
And when we, in 2016, studied the public school teaching staffs all across our region, Brighton was one of four districts in Monroe County that had one African-American teacher K-12.
Yes.
One. I mean, that's not a lot. And
certainly.
And your superintendent, who we know well, said, we care deeply about this. It matters. It's not the only thing that matters, but it definitely matters. I don't know the numbers today. I don't have an updated number. I mean, I certainly don't expect that it's much different. Do you see real effort being made in various districts and in Rochester, and what can be done that you sort of think is a solution?
You know, I certainly can't speak on behalf of my own district. That wouldn't be fair to be their mouthpiece at this time. But I do see that that effort is being made. And, you know, a lot of those efforts have to take place within classrooms. We need to make sure that we're allies as white teachers so that it starts in our own classrooms. And then, you know, it trickles down into the community. But there are efforts being made, and I respect those efforts. But in terms of our CSD, we need to start promoting from within, right? We already have a variety of programs that are doing really wonderful things to address this very thing and needs to be expanded. For instance, the Teaching and Learning Institute at East High School, they are developing future teachers right there. And that's a lot of that has been complemented just by that partnership with the U of R. I'd like to see that expanded district-wide because I think, you know, diversity matters and representation matters. So we have some programs that are working, and we need to replicate that. I'd like to see that expanded district-wide.
Willie, you've been on the board. When were you first elected to the board?
1997.
So, you know, the critics in this community have said, people who've been on the board for this long, we haven't seen change. You've had enough time. Why don't we have more teachers of color, for example?
We do have more teachers of color now than any of our counterparts in the Big Five, Buffalo, Syracuse, Yonkers, New York City. Our percentages are better now than they've ever been. In fact, this budget year, one of the solutions that we offered was early retirement for our older teachers, who, of course, are predominantly white, in order to make room that we can keep the newly hired, more diverse cohort. And we, the layoff numbers for this budget year, 200 teachers. The number of teachers that accepted the early retirement plan, 170. That's a lot of young teachers' jobs that were kept in place because we made a strategic decision to try to keep as many of the newest cohort of teachers, which is where our diversity efforts are, you know. I think one of the things that we really have to pay attention to is the value that we as a society place on teaching. When teachers, and we've had a decade and a half of severe teacher bashing through the whole No Child Left Behind and ESSA nationally, nobody wanted to go into teaching. Black, white, brown, yellow, nobody wanted to go into teaching because the entire profession had been disparaged as incompetent, unnecessary. You know, we're going to the country was deprofessionalizing teaching. If you want people to become teachers, then you have to hold it up as a profession worthy of their time and commitment. That's how you get young African Americans to go to college to be teachers and not to be scientists or mathematicians, which pays a whole lot better.
After our only break of the hour, we will come back to some of the questions from our listeners. You can email connections at WXXI.org. You can call the program with questions if you'd like for. You just heard Commissioner Willa Powell. Commissioner Reverend Judy Davis is here. Amy Malloy, a teacher who is running for school board, three of the candidates for Rochester City School Board for the June 25th primary election. This is the second in our series of three conversations with the full slate of teachers who are going to be, candidates who are going to be on that June 25th ballot. It's your chance to hear all of them. We'll take that break and come back to your questions for them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, the Democrat running for Monroe County Executive Adam Bello sits down with us. He's the Monroe County Clerk. We'll talk about why he wants the top job in the county. It's the first in our series of interviews. You will hear County Executive Cheryl Denolfo on a different date. In our second hour on Wednesday, a conversation about the state-level Green New Deal. Some activists are concerned that Albany is not going to produce anything when it comes to climate. This is Connections. Let's ask, I'll go around the table and ask all of the candidates for Rochester City School Board to respond to, got some feedback from listeners who are citing, among other people, Joe Klein was on the program recently, the chairman of Klein Steel, who's been an advocate for educational reform, a charter school advocate. I cite him because he happened to be the one on the show recently when the state takeover issue sort of first came up. But there's a number of people in the community who have pointed out their view that when we look at graduation rates, you can't just look at the graduation rate because of reports in Rochester that a number of students who graduate need quote-unquote remedial education, particularly in math and in English, and if this is a valid criticism. I mean, Reverend Davis, is that a valid criticism? Can we look at the graduation rate? How do you view this issue?
I would agree that when you have to take into consideration what are the students prepared to do when they graduate. This is one of the things that community organizing group in New York City uplifted. They were talking about that only 17 out of 100 students were able to read on grade level. And they also talked about needing remediation after they graduate. And they came together to demand high quality teachers, effective principals, family and community partnerships, and the ability to review the school processes. And so again, without that outside pressure to create the will within any system to do what needs to be done to educate children, I really believe that that's a valuable piece. And to go with that, what that educational group says, they determine that this is not about the failure of children or the failure of families. This is about the failure of the school. And that's what galvanized them to take a stand against a school that had uncertified teachers before their children, that had teachers who were just in the teaching profession 1 or 2 years, et cetera. So all those things contribute to the academic performance of children, and they wanted to make changes to improve the academic performance.
Are we measuring or assessing the right things, Reverend Davis?
I think we need to ask the critical questions, like what Klein said. What do these things actually mean? And that's a very good question. There was one parent who was coming to school every day. She was helping to volunteer cupcakes, you know, help with materials and everything. But it was a shock to her when she learned that her school was a receivership school. It was a shock to her when she learned that her own child was reading below grade level. So why isn't the community educated on what exactly is going on in our school systems? And so they helped her to come in to bake cookies and to bring materials, but not to educate on what's actually going on in the district and how we can need to make changes here.
Okay. Amy, what do you think?
You know, I have to say I disagreed with Mr. Klein. First and foremost, I don't think that charter schools are the Band-Aid solution for this district. And I also, you know, I opt my own children out of the state exams. High-stakes standardized tests are not necessarily indicators of college or career readiness. So I think that whatever we implement in our district, we need to make sure that it is research-based, that we are carefully working with our educational professionals. But high-stakes standardized tests are not everything. I'm not against assessment, but we have an obligation to design tests that are fair and that are adequately measuring student progress. And it should be used to inform instruction. You know, teachers should have immediate access to those scores so that they can reflect on their teaching and it informs instruction. So I don't think that the current tests that we have necessarily are doing a great job of, you know, assessing students' needs or where they're at. And I opt my own children out for that reason. But again, we need to make sure that students are career or college ready. And, you know, I required some remediation when I went off to college, when I went to U of R. And I credit that more with coming from a very economically disadvantaged background. I didn't have the same skill sets as some of my peers. And I was able to access tutoring through U of R to help bridge that gap. So yes, I think that some students require remediation, but we certainly need to not gauge all of that just on scores from standardized tests.
Commissioner Powell, what's the graduation rate today?
59% as of for last year. We can expect it to be over 60% by a considerable amount this year.
Is that the right way to measure it? And are you comfortable that those students who are graduating are prepared for whatever they need to be prepared for, whether it's quote-unquote college-ready, career-ready, or whatever the case is?
Well, it's still the only metric we have for exiting our students. It is the only metric we have right now. But I would argue that this is not a city school district problem. My husband teaches at RIT. I don't think you'll find too many Rochester City School District graduates in his program. He has students from the U of R, St. John Fisher, and Brockport that attend his program. And his constant annual gripe is that none of them know how to write. None of them know how to organize a paper and formulate a decent argument. And they were all graduates of suburban programs or schools throughout the state and country. So this framework of argument is not unique to the city school district. I think it became more of a hot point when the state decided that the Regents diploma was going to be the only diploma. When I went to school, there was Regents and local diploma, and to graduate the English, the senior English course, you had to do a term paper and research it and footnote it and argue your case. That's how you graduated with a Regents diploma back in 1980. There hasn't been such a requirement since the local diploma was eliminated. So I would argue that the state has diluted their standards in an effort to have a single diploma. The expectations have changed over the years, and it's not unique to the city school district.
I just wanted to go back and clarify that I wasn't making a statement on charter schools. I was making a statement about whether we should think critically about the skills that persons have when they graduate.
All right. Rebecca writes to us to say, "The more I hear, I become increasingly convinced that the best idea for the district is the boldest idea. We would be best off dissolving the district altogether. Keep the school buildings as community centers to provide those services that the guests today are discussing at the local neighborhood level. Distribute the students among the schools of the larger community of Monroe. I speak as a city resident for the record. The RCSD seems hopeless and has been for some 20 years now. The dysfunction drives middle-class parents out of the city, which threatens the very future of the city of Rochester. We must do better." That's from Rebecca. So Rebecca is concerned that parents, when kids reach school age, leave the city, go to the suburbs, which has been, in some cases, a pattern for years. Mm-hmm. Reverend Davis, let's start with you. Let's go around the table. Is there something you could say to parents who are feeling that pull, who don't feel like they can trust the district, don't want to stay in the district when their kids reach school age, what that says about the current scenario, and if you have an appeal to them at all regarding what the board can do to change that kind of calculus?
Well, I've actually talked to parents about this, and for themselves, how can you ask a parent who wants the best for their student, for their child who's working to create the best access and opportunity to stay in a neighborhood school or to stay at a school that is low performing? So I can understand the exit. I've watched people right on my own street exit Rochester to go to a different school district. And again, I continue to say that the answer for myself is a body of people that we've never considered, a body of people we've never allowed to live and flourish and uplift solutions. And again, that's the community at the forefront, grandparents, parents, et cetera, working together.
Okay. Amy?
Well, you know, it was a tough decision for me to stay in the city.
You've got four kids.
I do have four kids.
You teach
children.
In Brighton, but you've yes. got four kids in RCSD.
Yeah, and okay. I've been in Rochester for 25 years. I've always lived in the city of Rochester. And, you know, I noticed the segregation as soon as I arrived here to attend the U of R. There are just stark contrasts between the suburbs and the city. We're one of the most segregated cities, I would argue, in the United States. But I knew I wanted to raise my kids in the city because I knew that they would be getting more of a benefit socially there. And this is a family decision. But I knew that they would get a really good understanding of our society. And, you know, I wanted to stay. You know, it was a conscious decision by our family. And we started at our neighborhood school, and then eventually they were accepted at one of the magnet schools. They now attend World of Inquiry. And I love the expeditionary learning. And I think if we could replicate that type of situation across the city, more kids would have access to that. And all kids deserve access to that quality and that standard. And I think that if we could make those options available, more people, regardless of race, more middle class people, because that's really what this problem is, we have the flight of the middle class. And people want the best, as Judith said, for their kids. And they don't want to be stuck at a neighborhood school that is constantly failing. And I can empathize with that. I've been in that situation. I know. And that's why we have to take action. That's why we need to address, you know, the fact that, you know, 60% or more of our students live in poverty. And we can, other than going to a countywide school system, which is a wonderful idea on paper, and I fully support that, it would require suburban buy-in. And I don't think that we're going to see that anytime. I don't think we've reached that point as a community that's going to happen. But there are options, and we can create a school district that we can all be proud of by replicating the successes that we've seen in the district, whether that's SOTA or whether that's Wilson Magnet or, you know, the School 17 model. We can create a place that the middle class wants to stay in.
Are you concerned, Commissioner Powell, about parents deciding at school age time to leave Rochester?
I've watched this happen my entire career. And from the very beginning, you know, my four kids went through the city school district. And like Amy, the services are there, the opportunities are there, and I'd be a fool to pass it up. What I've seen in white flight, green flight, is people acting on a belief that the school district won't do right by their child. But I've also understood through my own lived experience, Amy's lived experience, that the parents who are making that choice, if they made a different choice, if they made the choice to stay, would find that their children would do just as well. In fact, if they stayed, not only would their children do well, but the entire class that their child is engaged with would do better. Because it's when you have economic diversity, 50%, you have to have at least 50% above the poverty line as well as below it to be truly economically diverse. And when you have that, you have a win-win situation. Everybody wins. The affluent kids gain a benefit from it, as well as the kids who can essentially use the affluent kids as an example, a role model. I read a book called The Ditch Digger's Daughter. An African-American man raised five girls and instructed his daughters, find the rabbit. Find the rabbit in your classroom and stay with them, and use that child as your benchmark on how to... when that happens in the classrooms, everybody wins. When families choose to leave and go to the suburbs, number one, you'll never get integrated. You'll never get the system Rebecca is asking for, because that's exactly what those families fled the city for. It's not just about the performance of the students in the classroom. It's who their neighbors are. And they didn't like...
Do you think it's an immoral choice for white families, generally speaking,
I have heard many families say, I really believe in diversity and living and in the city, but I can't risk my child's education.
So do you think it's an immoral choice?
When they say that, they have just told me that their values are not what they say their values are. They're making a choice that's at odds with their values. If you believe in it, then you're going to live it for your kids.
Can I address the economic, the refrain that economics is also is a major factor and more of a factor than racism? And I uplift this because we have studies that showed that most of our urban centers, you're going to have 85-90% white educators, and the student body itself is 90% black and brown. And studies have shown that white educators have lowered expectations for students. So they carry beliefs, that turns into actions and practices that a student can feel and understand. And so I uplift that has nothing to do with money. Being in the classroom with an educator that has lowered expectations of what you can perform and do academically has nothing to do with money. It has everything to do with needing anti-racist education, needing implicit bias training like what they're talking about now. And then when you have a nation in which racism is embedded, we have policies that we have implemented in our urban centers, such as tracking, purposely putting together low-ability students all through their K-12 in that same, instead of diversifying the abilities of our classrooms. So there's practices that occur in urban settings that have nothing to do with money, and that's what I'm talking about needs to be changed.
So when Rebecca brings up the idea of dissolve, and let's just go to Monroe County, the other districts, what Rebecca's talking about is what has been historically referred to as the pie slice idea, which is all the other 18 or 19 districts take a slice of the RCSD. It's a proposal. Again, what the political will is on any of this, it's hard to say, probably not much. Then the idea of a countywide district, Amy Malloy, I think at least signaling to something like Wake County, North Carolina, which in the 1970s did that, went to a countywide district, had basically benchmarks for how many students would be on free and reduced lunch and what the busing situation needs to be to achieve certain things. They say that it hasn't been perfect, but it's been pretty successful. But you only had at the time in the 70s there a municipal district and a county district. You're merging two. Here you'd be merging close to 20, something like that. But you're saying, Amy, that if we had the will, you'd actually be for it. You would be for it.
Oh, definitely. But I think that, you know,
we don't have the will for it, you think?
I don't think so. Not at this time. And I think that there have been politicians who have, you know, suggested that in the past. I know Bill Johnson called for that. And in a way, it's career suicide.
So let me just ask, though, because we're at a time where literally the mayor of Rochester is calling for a statewide takeover. And to answer an emailer named Dan's question earlier, who missed the early part of the hour, he's asking, are any of the candidates in favor of the state takeover? The answer is no. They all expressed understanding why people are frustrated. But they said this is the wrong solution, and I'm going to try to summarize because I want to keep moving here. The concern is that they don't think we should cede power to people farther away from the district, that change has to happen. In some cases, it has to be radical change, but ceding a state takeover is not what these candidates support. But in this moment, where people are talking about radical solutions, you're saying this would be a radical one, but you've sort of given up already on it. Well, is this a time for some kind of a radical solution?
You know, a countywide school system would require legislation, obviously.
Of course.
And that takes time. If someone wants to have the courage to, you know, propose that legislation, then we'll go from there. But at this time, that hasn't been done. And I don't think that it's necessarily related to, like, a state takeover. Are you saying that a state takeover could result in a countywide system? I just find a state takeover to be highly democratic. And as a social studies teacher,
a state takeover
that's
be highly
a disturbing
anti-democratic?
Trend.
You're saying anti-democratic.
Anti, that's what I meant.
Reverend Davis, would you support a countywide school system?
No. I would like to see the Rochester City School District become the best that it can be. And I believe it's possible. But again, it will take courageous people to take a stand and to address how racism has formed what we see right now today.
Commissioner Powell, would you support a countywide school system?
In theory, I wouldn't be opposed to it. But let's keep in mind that what we have is the system that we allowed to be designed for us. Decades and decades ago, the system we have of originally it was a voluntary transfer system, citywide busing in the high schools to avoid a court-ordered desegregation. We could just as easily find ourselves with a court-ordered desegregation today if the politics were different state and nationally. We have exactly the system that we were built to have. We have a city that gives away property tax dollars to developers to build luxury apartments. We end up with empty nesters or double income, no kid families that are going to move in with at a great tax break benefit and do nothing at all to help the families that have been left behind from this green flight, the concentrations of poverty in the city. That's what our local governance, our city governance, has allowed to happen. So, the economics that the city school district is facing was not of our making. We're just having to cope with it. And state practices that encourage families to move to suburbs was part of that aided and abetted this situation. The overall culture and racial bias that invites families to flee the city because they fear their neighbors has created this situation that we have today. And we, in order to walk it back, I believe that there's massive building going around in the city, massive luxury apartments. When double income, no kids families, young up and coming families decide to move into those places, I think the time will come when they decide they are going to have kids. And because they value urban living, I think that they're going to stay. And I think that we're going to see a shift. It's going to take 20 years. If you think we're going to turn around the school district in 2 years, we'll make incremental progress, but nothing will change until the entire fabric of this city changes.
Let me get Nate in Rochester on the phone just briefly because he wants to kind of share a quick story. Got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Nate.
No, thanks. Thanks so much, Evan. I have two kids at 23 School, which is an absolutely wonderful place. I actually went to city schools growing up. And their school, it just feels so much different than the schools that I went to growing up. Principal Gonzalez has done an amazing job turning a good school into a phenomenal school. And it's because it is a family. He's turned it into one giant, amazing family. And all of the family members really respect and care for each other. So one of the panelists, or maybe it was you, Evan, I don't remember, mentioned modeling the secondary schools that are doing well, SOTA, World of Inquiry, Wilson Magnet, and that's wonderful. But parents really are faced with an extraordinarily tough choice well before that. And it's when their kids are at the end of pre-K, they're going into kindergarten, and what are they going to do? There's the school, the citywide choices, and they are absolutely wonderful, don't get me wrong. But what if you don't? What if you put your name in the hat and you don't get one of those citywide choices? So it would be lovely to hear the panelists speak on modeling the successes of the elementary, the primary schools, because really, to me, it feels like that's where it really starts.
And 23 as an example. Thank you, Nate. So let's keep it tight and let's go around the table. What do you think, Commissioner Davis?
I think what Nate has identified is exactly what I've been talking about. That's a shared concern. That's a shared concern that parents, grandparents, community could come around, invite in those who can help to make that happen. And that's the kind of community organizing that I'm talking about that I would like to see us do here in Rochester to create the vehicles that are missing.
Okay, Amy?
I agree completely with Judith on this. I love School 23, Nate. My son went to pre-K there. Great school. We need to model that throughout the city. There are other gems, and we need to make sure that we're creating options in all of our neighborhoods, safe, walkable schools for our kids. The current placement and lottery system has unfortunately actually led to more segregation within the city. And yeah, School 58 is actually a K-12 school. I didn't know if Nate knew that, but maybe we need to make more of those models available for people. So it's really nice having all of your students or kids at one school, and it's working. It's clearly working there. So how can we replicate this across the city?
All right, Commissioner, about 25 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, School 23 has perhaps a tighter neighborhood association than some of our other schools, and there's a lot of people ask me, well, why are we doing busing in the elementary school? Why can't we just go back to neighborhood schools? And the answer is fundamentally is that if we in the city school district take away families' choices, they'll exercise other choices. You will see an explosion in charter schools. You will see more families leave. So I mean that horse is already out of the barn. But building a culture of family around the schools is the answer, and encouraging families to voluntarily choose their neighborhood schools, it helps you get to that.
Commissioner Willa Powell, Commissioner Reverend Judy Davis, and Amy Malloy, candidates for Rochester City School Board June 25th, the Democratic primary election in the city of Rochester. Thank you all for taking the time to be here. We appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, a week ago was our first conversation with other candidates, and we will have another one next week. So you'll hear all of the candidates in various days. City Council, City School Board, City Court Judge, your chance to understand the elections before you have to vote. Our thanks to David Griffin, the volunteer, Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.